the Epic of Gilgamesh. The famous Gilgamesh epic, or legend, survives in 12 tablets in Akkadian from the middle of the 2nd millennium BC, with fragments from Palestine from about 12,000 BC and from the Hittite capital Bogashkoi in Asia Minor. The legend is the final elaboration of a saga cycle of incidents associated with Gilgamesh, the king of the Sumerian city of Uruk in the first quarter of the 3rd millennium BC. That he really lived is indicated in a Sumerian fragment in epic style from the first half of the 2nd millennium BC, which records a war between Gilgamesh and the king of Kish. Gilgamesh was besieged in his city by the king and was grateful to accept his rival's terms. Thus, like King Arthur, he is a historical figure, though better known in legend than history. The opening of the text, "He who saw everything," Sanagbe Imuru, by which it is known in Mesopotamian literature, is curiously suggestive of the opening of Homer's Odyssey, with which it is not unworthy to be compared in scope and profundity. Indeed, it may be said to be more profound, since its highly entertaining narrative episodes are more strictly subordinate to the philosophic theme of the contrast between man's gifts and high aspirations and his physical limitations. The predominance of this philosophic theme puts the text in all its epic form into the category of books of wisdom, and it may well have been this influence which first created a literary unit out of the saga traditions of Gilgamesh. As in the Greek tragedy, man is represented by a figure of heroic proportions, in whom the problems of human destiny may be brought into sharp focus on a spectacular stage. In the king, man finds his closest affinity to the gods in the ancient Semitic world, as is expressed in the Akkadian saying, "Man, being the king, who is in the image of God." Thus, the problems of mankind are reflected in the experience of King Gilgamesh, who is, quote, "two-thirds a god and one-third human," which incidentally may be reflected in the legend of a race, the mighty men of renown, who were born of the union of human woman with the sons of God in Genesis 6, 1-4. The Gilgamesh legend opens somewhat surprisingly with a thrice-repeated complaint of the nobles of Uruk, that Gilgamesh leaves not the son to his father. Day and night, unbridled is his arrogance. Gilgamesh leaves not the maid to her mother, the warrior's daughter, the noble's spouse. This may be an incidental criticism of absolutism, including the ius prime noctis, the right of the lord to take the virginity of the daughters of his vassals, or it may be a reflection on the selfish impulse of human nature unbridled by limitation, or it may simply emphasize the freedom of a king from the normal limitations of ordinary men, just as the sage in Ecclesiastes casts himself hypothetically in the role of king in Jerusalem, with all that man could normally seek for his satisfaction and fulfillment, in order to emphasize the essential limitations of human life. Gilgamesh and Enkidu. In the context of the Gilgamesh legend, the passage serves to introduce Enkidu, the wild man of the steppe, first an antagonist worthy of the mettle of Gilgamesh, and then his faithful companion in his heroic exploits. The creation of Enkidu is an interesting variation of the Mesopotamian conception of the man fashioned out of the clay of the earth, with the addition of being conceived in the image of a high god and celestial ruler. A certain goddess, Aru, conceived the idea of a double of Anu and, washing her hands, pinched off clay and cast it in the divine image on the steppe. In both particulars, the substance of man and the image of God. This is the conception of the creation of man in Genesis 2.7. In the late wisdom of the book of Job, the same imagery and the same verb are used in the statement of the sage Elihu. "I stand in the same relationship to God as yourself. I too was nipped off from the clay." Enkidu is depicted as a wild man who knows neither people nor land, but feeds on grass with the gazelles and jostles with the wild beasts at the waterhole, an association which was broken after Enkidu's contact with civilization. The relationship of Enkidu with the beasts, as well as with Gilgamesh, the symbol of sophisticated urban civilization, reflects the interest of Mesopotamian sages in the harmony and tension in nature and society. Man and brutes, the solitary and the political man, the town dweller and the Bedouin of the steppe, the potential enemy or ally of the town dweller in Mesopotamia. The taming of Enkidu is the first of the exploits of Gilgamesh, which may reflect the adjustment of relations with the Bedouin that was regarded as the first task of the rulers of the Mesopotamian city-states. Before Gilgamesh and Enkidu could come to grips, however, the ground was prepared by the cunning of a hunter, who was persuaded to humanize the wild man by contriving that he mate with a woman. A temple prostitute is sent by Gilgamesh. She waits for Enkidu by the waterhole, and the mating takes place, quote, for 6 days and 7 nights. Then, quote, after he had had his fill of her charms, he set his face towards the wild beasts. But the metamorphosis had been effected, quote, man's dominion had broken nature's social union. On seeing him, the gazelles run off. The wild beasts of the steppe drew away from his body. Startled was Enkidu. His body became taut. His knees were motionless, for his wild beasts had gone. Enkidu had to slacken his pace. It was not as before, but now he had wisdom, broader understanding. He returns to the harlot, who proposes to introduce him to his new society in the city of Uruk. Persuading him with the prospect of animal satisfactions, the joyous abandon of festivals, lusty lasses, and Gilgamesh, who, like a wild ox, lords it over the folk. The strength of Gilgamesh is an irresistible challenge. Gilgamesh is warned of the coming of Enkidu, an epoch-making event in his life, by two dreams, one of a star which fell from the sky and proved an immovable obstruction, and the other of an axe which lay in his path. The two eventually meet, and a quarrel is provoked by Enkidu, resulting in an epic wrestling match. They met in the market of the land. Enkidu barred the gate with his foot, not allowing Gilgamesh to enter. They grappled each other, holding fast like bulls. They shattered the doorpost as the wall shook. Gilgamesh and Enkidu grappled each other, holding fast like bulls. They shattered the doorpost and the wall shook. As Gilgamesh crooked the knee, his foot on the ground, his fury abated, and he turned away. When he had turned away, Enkidu to him speaks up, to Gilgamesh. As one alone thy mother bore thee, the wild cow of the steer-folds, Ninsuna, raised up above man as thy head, kingship over the people Enlil has granted thee. The exploit against the giant Huwaba. The two then embark on a series of notable exploits. These exemplify the theme that, if man must accept his mortality and inferiority to the gods, he may yet win a name for himself and so live in posterity. Who, my friend, can scale the heavens? Only the gods live forever under the sun. As for mankind, numbered are their days. Whatever they achieve is but wind. Even here thou art afraid of death. But what of thy heroic might? Let me go before thee. Let thy mouth call to me. Advance, fear not. Should I fall, I should have made me a name. Gilgamesh, they will say, against fierce Huwawa has fallen. Gilgamesh, they will say. Gilgamesh, they will say, against the fierce Huwawa has fallen. Long after my offspring has been born in my house. So replies Gilgamesh to Enkidu, whose realism at this point serves as a foil to the bold enterprise of Gilgamesh in their first exploit to subdue Huwawa, also called Humbaba, the giant guardian of the cedar forest. This probably reflects the historical traditions of long expeditions from Mesopotamia, which had no heavy timber, to Syria, probably rather to the Amanus range in the northern Syria, than to the Lebanon. If the description of the cedar mountain as the abode of the gods is literal, as it may well be, this might indicate specifically Mount Zaphon, 20 miles north of Ras Shamra, which was the seat of Baal in the Ras Shamra myths. Professor Schaefer discovered an ancient cult place there. The description of the encounter with Huwawa, however, indicates a volcano. Huwawa, his roaring is the floodstorm. His mouth is fire. His breath is death. This, if indeed denotes a volcano, cannot refer to the Amanus or Lebanon. But since it is reported by Enkidu from the days when he roamed the steppe, it might denote the volcanoes of the Jebel Druz, known to the Mesopotamians from the reports of Bedouin caravaneers. Despite the discouragement from the elders of Uruk and inauspicious omens from Shamash, the sun god, who was the patron of Gilgamesh. The pair set out on their journey, which, in heroic convention, is accomplished at the rate of 50 leagues each day. At 20 leagues they broke off for a morsel. At 30 leagues they prepared for the night. They arrived at the entrance to the Cedar Forest, and the conflict with Huwawa is anticipated in a threefold dream. The heroes defy the giant by felling cedars, and the conflict ensues, the details of which unfortunately are lost. Eventually, Shamash intervenes, halting Huwawa with 8 strong winds, and the giant submits to the heroes, who decapitate their enemy. Gilgamesh spurns the goddess Ishtar. This exploit leads to the second, the suit of the goddess Ishtar for Gilgamesh, his repulse of her and the direful consequences. Ishtar's proposal to the hero clearly indicates her double character as a goddess of love and war. "Come, Gilgamesh, be thou my lover. Do but grant me of thy fruit. Thou shalt be my husband, and I will be thy wife. I will harness for thee a chariot of lapis and gold, whose wheels are gold and whose horns are brass. Thou shalt have storm demons to hitch on for mighty mules. In the fragrance of cedars thou shalt enter our house, where our house thou enterest. Threshold and dice shall kiss thy feet. Humbled before thee shall be kings, lords, and princes. The yield of hills and plains they shall bring before thee as tribute. The goats shall cast triplets, thy sheep twins. Thy he-ass as lading shall surpass thy mule. The chariot horses shall be famed for racing. Thine ox under yoke shall not have a rival." Gilgamesh spurns the advances of the goddess, citing various instances from nature and mythology where the love of the goddess has incited eventually to degrade and destroy, like that of Ruthus Circe in the Odyssey. The shepherd bird, in an illusion which is obscure, has momentarily enjoyed her love and is therefore condemned to perpetual lamentation, an explanatory myth accounting for the bird's cry, "Kapi, my wing." A shepherd has been the object of her fatal love, at the end to be turned into a wolf, to be hounded by his own herdsmen and worried by his own dogs, like Actaeon so destroyed by Artemis in Greek mythology. There is an allusion to explanatory myth about the mole, which was regarded as a metamorphosis of another victim, the temple gardener fatally loved by Ishtar. The momentary erotic ecstasy of the lion and the stallion are also contrasted with the downfall of the former in the hunt and the danger and fatigue of the war stallion, perhaps an allusion to the first stage in the taming of the beasts by the use of the female as a decoy. Ishtar's love had also excited the god of spring vegetation, Tammuz, the counterpart of Greek Adonis, in a seasonal nature cult. But she was not able to save him from annual death, which was bewailed by her own votaries in a seasonal ritual that was widespread throughout the ancient Near East and the Mediterranean world, and is specifically mentioned in Ezekiel 8:14 and implied in Zechariah 12:11. The motif of the repulse of the goddess of love is found also in Greek mythology in the myth of Artemis and Actaeon, and in Canaanite mythology in the repulse of Anat by the prince Arcot in the Rosh Shamra texts. There is another point of contact, the latter in that the goddess denounces the hero to the senior god of the pantheon, and by threats secures his approval or help to take vengeance. Similarly, Ishtar, with the threat that she will break down the gates of the underworld and release the dead to swallow up the living, induces Anu to send a 7-year drought and famine, another common saga motif amongst the Canaanites and in the Old Testament. This particular vengeance on Gilgamesh is probably connected with the conception of the ancient king as a channel of divine blessing in nature, like rain-making African chiefs who are tolerated as long as they are deemed effective. However that may be, the drought and famine are depicted as a redoubtable monster, the bull of heaven, the power of the plague god Nergal. This was the god who was active in the intense heat of the sun at midday and in the summer solstice, the hot desert wind being his breath, which in one fragmentary passage is said to be alone sufficient to slay men in hundreds. The heroes, however, slay the bull of heaven, offering its heart to Gilgamesh's patron, Shamash, and with a truly heroic, if ungallant gesture, throw the hind leg in Ishtar's face. So Gilgamesh and Enkidu return in triumph to Uruk, and in a greeting well known to the Old Testament, such as in Exodus 15:20-21, after the crossing of the Red Sea, they are welcomed by the antiphonal chanting of women, who play the harp to the theme suggested by the hero's boast. Who is most splendid amongst the heroes? Who is most glorious among men? Gilgamesh is most splendid amongst the heroes. Gilgamesh is most glorious amongst men. The hero's boast, the prerogative of the ancient warrior, as a suggestion for a theme to the woman welcoming home the warrior, may explain the mention of the wives of the patriarch Lamech in Genesis 4:23. Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. Ye wives of Lamech, hearken to what I say. I have slain a young man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 77-fold. The death of Enkidu. The Gilgamesh legend in its extant version reaches its dramatic catastrophe with the death of Enkidu, which is foreshadowed by Gilgamesh's dream of a dispute in the Celestial Council. At the instance of Enlil, the executive of Anu, a life is claimed for the sacrilege in killing the bull of heaven, and Enkidu is stricken with mortal illness. He suffers one day, a second day, and so on to the conventional 12th day of Mesopotamian legend, a reflection of the sexagesimal system which was the basis of Mesopotamian mathematics. This is the opportunity for the sage who composed the legend to assess, through the dying Enkidu, the worth of human endeavor and aspiration after achievement and fame for its own sake, as against the travail and physical suffering which they involve. To the ancient Mesopotamian, as to the Hebrew in Old Testament times until the 2nd century BC, there was no prospect that he should, after death, rest from his labors, and his work should follow him. Enkidu knows that he's being led to, quote, the house of darkness, the abode of Irkalla, to the house which none leave who have entered it, on the road from which there is no way back, to the house wherein the dwellers are bereft of light, where dust is their fare and clay their food. They are clothed like birds with wings for garments, and see no light, residing in darkness. In the house of dust which I entered, I looked at rulers, their crowns put away. I saw princes, those born to the crown, who had ruled the land from the days of yore. This passage recalls Job 3:13-19. I should have slept, then I should have been at rest, with kings and counselors of the earth. There the wicked cease from troubling, and the wary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Enkidu's final word, however, declares that a death in action on some high enterprise is a blessing, and that had been a consolation of man up until the part of the text. But when death comes obscurely as the result of disease, the problem of human limitation weighs more heavily on the sage and his hero. Gilgamesh mourns Enkidu, recalling his significance and exploits, as David recalled those of the dead Saul and Jonathan in Samuel. The axe at my side, my hand's trust, the dirk in my belt, the shield in front of me, my festal robe, my richest trimming. An evil demon rose up and robbed me. O my younger friend, thou didst chase the wild ass of the hills, the panther of the steppe. Enkidu, my younger friend, thou who didst chase the wild ass of the hills and the panther of the steppe. We who have conquered all things, scaled the mountains, who seized the bull and slew him, brought affliction on Huwawa, who dwelt in the cedar forest. What now is the sleep that hath laid hold on thee? Thou art benighted and canst not hear me. But he lifts not up his eyes. He touched his heart, but it does not beat. Then he veiled his friend like a bride, storming over him like a lion, like a lioness deprived of her whelps. He paces back and forth before the couch, pulling out his hair and strewing it, tearing off and throwing down his finery as though unclean. Having presumably buried Enkidu and made funeral offerings, Gilgamesh turns earnestly to the quest, now no longer for fame but for life itself. Alone now, he undertakes long and arduous journeys through the bounds of human habitations to Utnapishtim, who had survived the flood in Sumerian legend, and had with his wife been granted eternal life at the remote outflowing of the rivers. He meets with various obstacles, but is not deterred. First, he arrives at the mountains at the rim of the world, where the frontier is guarded by scorpion men. Their chief endeavors to persuade Gilgamesh of the futility of his mission, but in vain. Eventually, after a long journey through the dark mountain barrier visualized apparently to the north, where the fruits are semi-precious stones, he encounters by the sea, presumably the Mediterranean, a female named Shiduri, which means, in the non-Semitic Hurrian language of those regions, young woman. She is presumably a minor deity and is described as an alehouse keeper. At first alarmed at the stranger and barring him out, she proves true to her calling and is a ready confidant, and Gilgamesh tells her his trouble. "He who with me underwent all hardships, Enkidu, whom I loved dearly, who with me underwent all hardships, Enkidu now is gone to the fate of mankind. Day and night I have wept over him. I could not give him up for burial, in case my friend should rise at my plaint. 7 days and 7 nights, until a worm fell out of his nose. Since his passing I have not found life. I have roamed like a hunter in the midst of the steppe. Oh, alewife, now that I have seen thy face, let me not see the death which I have ever dread." Her reply is to offer him the practical advice that he should forsake the vain quest for immortality and exploit the natural advantages of life and fulfill his natural desires. "Gilgamesh, whither rovest thou? The life thou pursuest thou shalt not find. When the gods created mankind, death for mankind they set aside, life in their own hands retaining. Thou, Gilgamesh, let thy belly be full. Make thou merry by day and by night. Of each day make thou a feast of rejoicing. Day and night dance thou and play. Let thy garments be sparkling fresh. Let thy head be washed. Bathe thou in water. Pay heed to the little one that holds on to thy hand. Let thou spouse delight in thy bosom. For this is the task of mankind." But Gilgamesh persists in his quest and is not deterred by her warning that he must follow the sun's path to the waters of death, over which he must be ferried by the boatman Ur-Shanabi, the Mesopotamian counterpart of the Greek Charon, ferryman over the Styx. On meeting Ur-Shanabi, Gilgamesh answers the same questions that Sururi had put to him with the same statements of his grief for the death of his friend, and the same account of their exploits together and the death of Enkidu. To his request to be ferried over, Ur-Shanabi replies that Gilgamesh had, apparently inadvertently, destroyed certain stone amulets necessary for the voyage. Now he must provide 60 stout punting poles shod with ferrules. Such a large number was necessary, since none might be used for more than one thrust, and none of the waters of death must be touched by hand. After sailing a normal voyage of a month and a half in 3 days, they reached the waters of death, where the poles were brought into use. These were all used up, and the resourceful Gilgamesh was obliged to complete the voyage using his loincloth as a sail. Utnapishtim sees him in the distance. The encounter is not actually described, but in a fragmentary passage the same questions are put and the same answers given as at Gilgamesh's meeting with Siduri and Ur-Shanabi. To Gilgamesh's request for eternal life, Utnapishtim's answer is not encouraging. "Do we build a house forever? Do we seal contracts forever? Do brothers divide shares forever? Does hatred persist forever in the land? Does the river forever raise up and bring on floods? The dragonfly leaves its husk, that its face might but glance at the face of the sun. Since the days of yore there have been no permanence. The resting of the dead, how alike they are! They do not compose a picture of death. The commoner and the noble, once they are near to their fate. The Anunnaki, the great gods, foregather. Mamatu, the maker of fate, with them the fate decrees. Death and life they determine, but of death its days are not revealed.